Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest OIES podcast, which is being brought to you by the GAS programme. My name is James Henderson. I'm Head of GAS Research at OIES, and with me today is my esteemed colleague, Professor Jonathan Stern. And we're going to be talking about three events that have happened over the last few months that have, we think at least, significant implications for the gas sector. They were the G7 meeting, which took place in Hiroshima back in May, the LNG 23 conference, which took place in the second week of July in Vancouver, and then most recently, on the 18th of July, the LNG producer-consumer conference, which took place in Japan. And Jonathan was certainly present at one of them and has been following the other two with an eagle eye. So, Jonathan, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
And I should just mention before we go on that we're recording this on the 11th of August. But without further ado, let's go on to the first question. Let's start with G7. And I think the thing that many people in the gas market noticed then was how, if I'm correct, the sort of final document highlighted the important role of LNG, which I think was a surprise to many. What was your take on the outcome of the G7?
Well, I mean, we had this interesting intervention in the communique, which I'm just going to quote what it says. In this context, we stress the important role that increased deliveries of LNG can play and acknowledge that investment in the gas sector can be appropriate in the context of the current crisis. And I think many people, including myself, thought that Japan had inserted that phrase possibly against the wishes of a number of other OECD countries. So I think it was a fairly controversial insertion, but possibly just emphasised how important Japan sees the role of LNG as.
Do you think this highlighted a kind of divide then between views in different parts of the world about the role of gas?
I think it probably does. I mean, you think you have at least three different views around the world. The view that basically gas is going to be with us for a very long time, and LNG is going to be a very large part of that. The view that we should be phasing out gas and LNG as fast as we can. And then there's another view really from the developing world about monetizing their resources, and maybe we should come back to that a little later on.
Does the communique from the G7 have much weight? I mean, it's just an indication of intention, or what do you think it'll actually influence investment decisions?
Well, I think it gives heart to investors that actually investing in LNG is something that has been approved in some shape or form by major countries around the world. I don't want to give too much credence to this because it's interesting how quickly all of these meetings and statements are forgotten. I mean, I think probably a lot of people would struggle to tell you when that meeting was and we're only 3 months further on. So I wouldn't attach too much importance to it, but certainly the industry attaches enormous importance to it and quotes it a lot at the conferences.
I mean, and you were in Japan earlier this year, and did this basically reflect the sense that you were getting talking to people in and around Tokyo about their sense of what needs to happen in the LNG market?
I think when you go to anywhere in Asia, but particularly Japan, and you're coming from Europe where there's such a big pressure to decarbonize, you sense immediately that security of supply is front and center at the top of the agenda for governments and companies. I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're not interested in sustainability, but it's very much in second place. And I think that was always the case, but the crisis of 2022 has really emphasized that enormously. And I think in Europe, it's easy to underestimate how important security is in these countries, many of which, or indeed most of which, are import dependent to quite a substantial extent.
Okay, well, let's move then from G7 to LNG 23 in Vancouver. Now, you were chairing, I think, quite a lot of the sessions there. So you probably had a pretty good impression of what the overall feeling of the conference was. I mean, did this kind of statement from the G7 kind of give a real boost to the conference and to people playing in the gas market?
I think it certainly featured in many of the plenary speeches by senior government and industry officials. But what I would say is that there is a huge kind of gung-ho feel about the LNG community, which is that LNG is going to be with us for a very long time, and we need a lot more LNG globally. And almost irrespective of what happens to gas as a fuel, the LNG business is going to be great for a very long time. I wouldn't say that there was no mention of the sustainability issues, because in some of the breakout sessions we had good debate on and technical debate on some of those issues. But for the policy people, for the industry people talking about strategy, you had the feeling that it's kind of onwards and upwards for LNG for as far as ahead as we can see.
Okay, I mean, the conference was based in Vancouver, so was the focus mainly North America and Asia, given the specific location?
I mean, yes, it was, because, of course, North America, you've got the big push for additional projects, and it's not just the US, but also Canada. In Asia, you had this strong sense that, well, now we've got big competition from Europe for LNG, which is never how we saw it prior to 2022. We always saw Europe as the market of last resort for LNG. Now it's the premium market for LNG, and a lot of debate about how that and whether that would continue. It was at a strange time, the conference, because obviously we've just come out of perhaps the peak of the crisis, although everyone's at great pains to tell us we're not out of the wood yet, which I think is quite right. But it's becoming increasingly likely that we won't see another year like 2022, certainly in terms of prices and the amount of stringency in the market. So, you know, the North Americans and Asians dominated, and Europeans were present, but perhaps not to the extent that one might have expected if that conference had been held, say, 6 months earlier.
It's interesting that everyone's so bullish because, the IEA have obviously come out with forecasts that show a downgrading of their gas demand over the next 20 or 30 years. Mike Fullwood, our colleague, has come out with a paper looking at gas demand to 2030, which again downgrades his estimates for demand over the rest of this decade. Was the sense at this conference that actually demand's going to, carry on rising? And what about coal to gas switching? Is that still seen as a major driver of gas demand in Asia?
Everybody talks about coal to gas switching as a major driver of gas demand, particularly in Asia, but potentially elsewhere. I mean, there's a lot of play made of the fact that, of course, in the crisis, Europe had to use more coal. But I think there's a really important issue here for the LNG community. And I'm not saying that this is a correct perception that, look, whatever happens to gas, LNG is going to be great because everyone's going to need to import more. Their domestic production is declining. They may want to reduce the role of gas in their energy balances. But for LNG, it won't make much difference because they will still need to import. Pipeline gas in Europe is largely gone. Russia is not coming back. Asia may do a few pipelines, particularly in China, but that's not going to actually take up the huge increase in demand for gas that people see in Asia. So that narrative was very much to the fore. Now, I'm a little uneasy about that narrative because I think it's easy, if you're in a particular industry pushing these projects, to say that actually that is reality. But what you have to say is that when you look at the number of FIDs that are happening and the number of projects that are on the stocks for the next few years, you wouldn't rule out the next few years being very strong for new LNG projects and also very strong for global LNG demand.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you talk about new projects and we should come on to the supply. I guess most of the new supply was being seen from North America. But our analysis has suggested that actually beyond 2026, if anything, there might be something of a glut and that prices could come back well into single digits in terms of dollars per MMBTU. Was there any sense of concern that actually there might be too many FIDs and too many projects coming on?
Absolutely not. There's no concern at all about that. You could say, yeah, but people look at what's happening now and what's happened in the last year. But for me, in a sense, something more interesting than this. People were talking about the 2030s, the 2040s, LNG as a destination fuel. there was no real sense that sustainability, net zero, was going to have a major impact on LNG, even if it had an impact on gas. And as I say, coming from Europe, you kind of wonder if you're in an alternative reality, given how much stress on net zero issues and targets we have in Europe. But I think it was a very, I always like going outside Europe because you realize that there are strong differences in views, even taking account, this is the fossil fuel community speaking, there are strong differences in views between these regions.
So let's come on to that kind of whole decarbonisation, emissions, environmental discussion. You said there had been some side meetings at which there had been some good and detailed discussions. Before we go there, was there any discussion in the main conference about environmental issues, or was it merely for the kind of the interested parties who were prepared to discuss it outside the main conference?
I would say the latter. The main conference, the plenary sessions were all about how gas was great for the environment, how it was better than coal, how it was better than oil, how it was good for air quality. And you know, you wouldn't disagree with any of those necessarily. What was missing from the plenary sessions was a sense that, are we still trying to meet net zero? Because if we are trying to meet net zero, this is going to have an impact on gas and probably LNG.
And so what was discussed then in these sort of side events? Were you talking about emissions from the LNG value chain? Were you talking about CCUS and the decarbonisation of the gas value chain overall? What were the discussions?
We're talking about all those issues, but the ones that I was able to be at, which I thought were the most interesting, were sessions where we had project and company people talking about their efforts to reduce methane in particular, but greenhouse gas emissions in general from the LNG value chain. And the kind of interesting thing about that was that they were able to tell us that they were using, for example, the GII, GNL methodologies, the SGE methodologies. What is missing from them and also more general discourse is, okay, so tell us the detail. We want to know the detail and particularly the data on how you do this for an individual project. So for project X delivering a cargo to country Y, what are the emissions and how did you measure them? Now, the problem with this is that these are still regarded by many companies as confidential. And when you inquire as to, well, why is this confidential? You get a range of answers. One answer is, well, we would be prepared to release them, but our joint venture partners would not be prepared to release them. Another answer is, well, if we release the emissions, it will allow competitors to see what our production is, and we don't want that. And there's a lot of different things. But the key problem is that now we kind of see that a lot of companies, not all, but a lot of companies are taking major steps to measure emissions. What we haven't got is the kind of credibility that we would need by releasing the data and the methodology behind this. And when you speak with NGOs and you say, well, they regard this as confidential, you'll get a reply like, yeah, we know what confidentiality means. It means that your emissions are 10 times what you say, but you don't want to own up to it. This is a big problem.
Okay. And you know, was there a broad acceptance that, you know, things need to change and that there needs to be, you know, more work done, more revelation, if you like, of the data or not?
Well, yes and no. There's almost a kind of, well, if we're required to do this by regulators, obviously we'll do it. And you know, in the US, this is definitely happening with the IRA Act. In Europe, it may or may not be happening if we get a methane regulation, which unfortunately looks a little less likely, at least this year. But also, we've got the EU ETS covering transportation from next year, which is not a full disclosure of the LNG train, but it's a start. The hope is that this will actually start to happen. But my concern is that the industry is taking a huge amount of time to recognise that this is a very important issue for its future.
Okay, well, let me take you to the producer-consumer dialogue then, which happened in Japan. And there, on this issue, there was, if I am correct, a signing of a coalition for LNG emissions abatement. Is that something that is taking this issue forward in a more serious manner?
Well, I think it's taking the issue forward. And I think if we just go back to what happened at the G7 meeting, there's a sense that, well, if you're going to stress that LNG is still going to be a very important issue, then you also need to stress that the greenhouse gas emissions are going to be reduced from it and you're doing something about that. And I think we can tie those things together. The problem with the coalition or so-called clean initiative, as it's called, is that we don't really have any detail about it. A lot of people have signed the document. This is good. We don't want to discount the fact that actually people are now saying this is a serious issue. Important countries are saying it's a serious issue. But the problem is, when you don't have any detail, you come back to the issues we just were talking about, which is, yeah, fine. But actually, can we see that anything is happening as a result of you signing this document?
So you've mentioned the IRA and the US, and obviously the LNG23 was in Canada. Are those the only places where things are happening? I mean, what would you say is happening around the world on the methane issue particularly?
The focus of real action has switched to North America. And we've got the IRA, which is going to be establishing a methane fee for emissions over certain limits from next year. And from 2026, that's going to have to be on the basis of actual measurements, not just engineering estimates. The Canadians have done an enormous amount. I think people aren't quite aware of how much has happened in Canada on these issues, both federally and from the different provinces. North America appears to be the center of real policy action and charging for methane emissions. In Europe, obviously, we've been preoccupied with the crisis for the last year, and a lot of environmental legislation in Brussels has taken a back seat. It looks like we're not going to get a regulation passed this year. We still might, but it's looking far less likely. We are going to get something from the EU ETS, but the kind of really aggressive document of the methane strategy back in 2020, which looked like we were going to get charging for imported methane emissions associated with gas and LNG, that seems to have been substantially watered down. Again, I wouldn't say it's not going to happen. Certainly doesn't look like it's going to happen quickly. But then, of course, outside Europe and North America, we've talked about the security issue in Asia. There was quite a lot of, I say, developing country, but you're putting countries like Nigeria and Malaysia in the same basket, which you probably shouldn't do. It's hard to know how to describe them in one phrase. But I mean, you're getting the same sense from them that don't tell us that we can't develop our domestic resources. This is a way in which we are going to develop and actually improve living standards in our country. And we don't want to be lectured by countries who have used these fossil fuels for decades and are now think they've got to be phased out and transferring that to us who have a completely different development experience.
I think it's interesting you brought up the developing countries because there's two issues, it strikes me, in developing countries. The first is the one you've mentioned, which is the monetization of indigenous resources. And the second is, for those who don't have indigenous resources, is the cost of energy and the price that we saw gas reaching last year and the impact that had, because countries like Pakistan and Bangladesh obviously were short of gas supply. Let me just ask about the price question first. Has there been much discussion? I mean, you mentioned we're not going to see 2022 again, but was there much discussion of price and what perhaps an equilibrium price might be and what impact that might have on the future of gas demand in emerging countries?
I suppose the straight answer to that is no. I chaired a session on pricing, and essentially what I was trying to get at there was, well, how do we feel about the last year? Are we now confused about whether we want crude oil linked pricing, as we do have still a lot of it in Asia, or spot pricing, market pricing, as we have in Europe and North America? And my sense was that a lot of developing countries took the view that basically they preferred crude oil prices. When I said to them, are you saying that because that meant lower gas prices in the last year compared with spot prices? The answer appeared to be yes, but also we don't really understand how we're going to tie our imports into maybe TTF. We can see how we could tie them into Henry Hub. But then, of course, there was a different experience when prices were very low in 2020 and Henry Hub was relatively high. So I think there's confusion here. A lot of countries, well, in fact, everybody was caught out by the rise in prices in 2022. Now we're back to more quote unquote normal prices, although I would argue that $9 to $11 a million BTU is actually not a normal range for prices. It's a high range. But I still think that there's a lot to be said here about if you're going to sign a long-term contract, what are you going to say about price indexation? And are you going to say something along the lines of, yeah, we want 3-year reviews or 5-year reviews maybe, and what does that say for the financing of projects? There's a lot of discussion about, yeah, we can see that there are problems, but finance people want long-term contracts and they don't want a spot price that they don't really understand how it can work. When you say to them, yeah, well, do you really understand how Brent crude works? I think their answer is, well, we're used to that. We can deal with it. Whereas TTF, we can't deal with.
I mean, on the financing question, I guess one of the criticisms that I've heard from developing countries is that, you know, the developed world is now more reluctant to finance hydrocarbon-based projects, even gas projects, in regions like Africa particularly. And yet we come back to this G7 statement that about the important role of LNG and investment in the gas sector. Is the sense now that, you know, when looking at developing countries with indigenous resources, potentially for export as well as use domestically, that we are going to see more investment now and that governments are backtracking on that reluctance to invest in hydrocarbons?
My feeling is that that is likely to be correct, but only if the finance people can get their 15 to 20 year contracts, which means somebody's got to sign a 15 to 20 year contract with them. For China, I think that's fine. Maybe other Asian countries, but probably not big volumes. And this is, I think, going to be the problem for developing countries with indigenous resources. Unless they can get a portfolio player, which you know, you've seen in Mozambique, for example, unless they get a portfolio player to actually underwrite the finance, then I think they could still be in some difficulty. I mean, I think it's interesting that even in the US, you've seen some difficulty in financing for those projects that don't have portfolio players supporting them. So I think the jury's out on this. We need, I think, a few more months, possibly another year, until we see how pricing and therefore the general stringency of 2022 is unwinding. Whether it's unwinding quickly or whether, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, we've got to wait till 2026 before we see a more normal, balanced market.
Okay. I mean, look, we're coming to the end of our time now, so let's try and draw this to a conclusion. From what you've been saying, the gas community at least seems very bullish about the future, particularly the LNG community. There seems to be some more political backing given security of supply concerns for investment in the sector, and the outlook's pretty positive. But from what you've been saying, you know, the impact on the environment and concerns over decarbonisation seems to be taking a back seat, which is clearly not such good news. Is that how you'd summarise, or what else would you add?
That's how it looks at the moment. What I think is very difficult to know is how events, particularly climate-related events, are going to impact buyers and governments in importing countries, and whether that is going to accelerate not just a desire to phase out fossil fuels, but actually putting money behind net zero initiatives. Now, you could argue that even if that happens, gas will be the last to suffer. But what I would say is I'm concerned that the gas community is a little bit overconfident about its long-term future, which may be different to its future over the next 2 or 3 years.
Okay, well, on that note, thank you very much indeed, Jonathan, for your time. That's been a fascinating discussion. We'll obviously be picking up a lot of these issues at our own sponsors meeting and our gas day, which take place in October. But until then, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you to all our listeners for tuning in. We'll be back with another Gas Program podcast in a couple of weeks. But until then, take care of yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.